Welcome to our sermon podcast here at City of Light Anglican Church. We are a new church in Aurora, Illinois, finding a new day in Jesus. We want to see the light of Jesus rise and shine in our hearts, in our homes, and in our neighborhoods. Thanks for joining us for today's message from Father Trevor.
When I was about 14, at the end of June, on a summer weekend, as warm and hot as this one, in 1998, I was at Tiger Stadium watching the visiting Chicago Cubs play. And I was there because that summer there was a historic home run record race going on. Maybe you remember it, maybe you weren't alive yet, but there had been a record set in 1961 by Roger Maris for the most home runs ever hit in a Major League Baseball season, 60 home runs. And no one had come anywhere close to that record for almost 40 years. And then in 1998, Sammy Sosa was chasing after that record, and Mark McGwire was chasing after that record. And I just wanted to be there in the midst of all that excitement, even if it was watching the Tigers play. They were very, very bad in 1998. And if you follow to the end of the season, Mark McGwire ended up with 70 home runs, breaking the record by 10 home runs, and Sammy Sosa had 66. And then 2 years later, Barry Bonds hit 73. But if you look up those records today, by those numbers for Barry Bonds, 73, and Mark McGwire, 70, and Sammy Sosa, 66, there's an asterisk by each one of those numbers because they've all been accused of using illegal performance-enhancing steroids. Barry Bonds admitted it. Mark McGwire admitted it. It seems like whenever Sammy Sosa gets asked, he pretends he doesn't understand the question. But it's likely that he did. In fact, during those three seasons, 98, 99, 2000, at least 15 of the top 20 home run hitters have been linked to using illegal performance-enhancing drugs. I read an interview with Mark McGwire from a couple years later where he admits using steroids, and he says, it was a mistake. I wish I hadn't done it. He regrets it. And then he says, because I didn't need to. I would have hit 70 home runs without it. And my first reaction to that when I read it was, okay, that's not a very good confession. Like, I hear a lot of confessions. Like, that one doesn't count. Like, that's not very good. You're still justifying what you did, right? But my second reaction was, prove it. You think you could have hit 70 home runs without steroids? Prove it. But he can't. He'll never know whether or not he could have. He'll never have that season and that peak moment of his career, which was a great career. He'll never have that back. He'll never know if he could have done it. He lost that opportunity when he cut corners, when no one else was watching, when he thought no one else would find out, and he took those drugs. He lost his shot to do it on his own. He likely would have been a Hall of Famer, but now he probably never will be. And when we think of him, we don't think of an amazing talent, which he had. We think of the fact that he cheated. At the heart of the story of the book of Ruth that we've been reading, we have Ruth and we have Boaz, and they are two characters that do what is right. When no one else is looking, they don't cut corners, they don't compromise, they live and make decisions, and they act with integrity, with character, with what the Bible calls righteousness, doing what is right. Now, when we hear that word righteousness, I don't know about you, but sometimes my first reaction to the word righteousness is thinking about, oh, someone who's self-righteous. And that's not a great picture of somebody thinking, oh, maybe you think that they're better than other people or that they're the only ones who know what's right and so everyone else is wrong. And so someone who's self-righteous is kind of judgmental. Maybe you've met someone that has said and says they do what's right, but they actually do it with kind of a hard heart or even with a hateful heart. You think, oh, that's self-righteous. I don't want to be like that. That's not what the word righteousness is talking about. That's not what righteousness in the Bible is. There's a Bible teacher and scholar named Daniel Block, and he connects the book of Ruth to this passage in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is another book in the Old Testament of the Bible where God is teaching his people what is good and what is right for them in their personal life and for them as a community. What is good? What will lead to your good and your flourishing and your blessing? And as Moses is teaching the people what God says is good, he says this. He says, pursue righteousness. Pursue only righteousness. He says it twice. Pursue righteousness, only righteousness. Follow God's way. Follow what he says is for your good and for the good of others. But over and over again, especially during the period that the Ruth story is taking place, the period of the judges, the people of Israel don't follow God's way. The refrain in the book of Judges over and over is, and there came a generation that did what was right in their own eyes. They wanted to decide what was for their own good. And over and over again, what they wanted to do led to their own suffering and to their own pain. Righteousness isn't about what I think is right and what you think is right and one of us being wrong. Righteousness is about what God says is right. And not just right for us as individuals, but what God says is good for us, but for others. It's not about just being good. It's about living for the good of everyone. This righteousness actually isn't just about yourself. It's about God, and it's about others, and it's about all of us. In the Bible, righteousness and justice are often synonymous. They're often the same. So that same passage sometimes is translated, pursue justice, only justice. And in our culture right now, we don't have as much of a hang-up about saying, we want to be a just person. We want to be righteous. That's what that's saying. When we see leaders or people in our families or in our local communities or in our nation who don't do what is good for others, we say, that's not right. When they don't stand up and take a stand to end suffering, we say that's not right. When people actually cause or promote suffering by their own selfish actions, by their decisions, by their policies, by their use of resources and money, when they do it for their own gain or their own power or their own gratification, we go, that is not right. I mean, aren't we seeing that on our national scale this week? As we have a policy that's separating children from parents, and we go, hey, we can debate about immigration, but that's not right. What we're saying is, that isn't righteous. And don't we long for people in our lives and for our leaders to be righteous, to do what is right for the good of everyone and for what God says is good. And in Ruth and Boaz, we see a man and a woman who live with righteousness. They follow what God says is right and good, and that means that they show hesed. They show this loyal love for one another. They don't cut corners. In hard situations, they don't compromise. They don't take what seems like the easy way out. They take God's way. Even when God's way seems, in the moment, less likely to succeed, riskier, harder, they take God's way. They risk for what's right. Mark McGwire, the baseball player, he wishes he hadn't cut corners. Maybe in your life, there are places where you wish you hadn't cut corners. You wish you'd been the same person in private that you are in public. Compromise always comes with regret. Righteousness never does. Never regret following God's way. But what I want to see in this story this morning is the beauty of righteousness. The goodness of righteousness and following Jesus. So turn with me to Ruth chapter 3, page 343, if you're using one of the Bibles on the chairs. Maybe you've been following along with us on this story. Maybe this is your first time here, and so you're jumping into the story of Ruth in chapter 3. But the end of chapter 2 ends with kind of an ominous warning. Verse 23 of chapter 2 says, "The barley and wheat harvest were finished." That means that Ruth and Naomi, who've been surviving on the gleanings, the kind of leftovers of the harvest, their temporary employment is now over and they're out of a job and they don't know where their next meal is going to be coming from because the harvest is over. So the harvest has been providing for them, but now it's not going to provide for them anymore. And so Naomi says to Ruth, "We need another plan." And in chapter 2, Naomi had identified this guy named Boaz, who owns one of the fields and is in charge of harvesting one of the fields, as a guardian redeemer. That's in chapter 2, verse 20. He's a guardian redeemer, a close relative. Now, if you're using one of the Bibles on the chairs, you see that after it says guardian redeemer, there's a little letter B, and you can follow down to the bottom of the page where there's another little letter B, and that explains what this term guardian redeemer means, because it's a technical legal term for the law of the people of Israel. And it means that if someone has gone through something catastrophic in their life, that their next closest relative is responsible to help get them out of it. And so that would sometimes be a material loss. Let's say their house floods and they don't have a home. The next closest relative would step in and go, "It's my job, according to the law, to provide for you." It's a beautiful law for taking care of one another. It's unfortunate that we need laws for taking care of one another, but there it is. Well, in the case of someone who's become a widow, the closest unmarried male relative would then marry that woman so that she could be provided for. To be a widow in this culture left you incredibly economically vulnerable. And so it was the family's job to care for that vulnerability through marriage in this culture. So the next of kin, the closest relative, would have the legal obligation to bring them back out of that situation. Now, some have read this chapter 3 passage, and this is kind of a recent phenomenon, and they've wondered, is Naomi asking Ruth to do something inappropriate here? Is Naomi asking Ruth to seduce Boaz? And as I've been studying the book of Ruth, and I've gone to commentators and Bible scholars that I trust, they're all really uniform. No, that's not what they think is happening. I just want to put that right out there so we can clear that up. And there's several reasons why Naomi's not asking Ruth to do something inappropriate and Ruth isn't doing something inappropriate. If you look at the actual word choice, some people say, is this language euphemistic? It's not if you dig into it. Boaz doesn't react as if Ruth is propositioning him. He actually says, "Wow, everyone said you're of great character and now you've proved it." Also, the narrator repeatedly praises them and calls them noble. In chapter 2, Boaz is introduced by saying he's a noble person, which is to say he's righteous. And then when Ruth comes to Boaz at night, he says, "Everyone said that you were righteous." But one of the most compelling reasons, to understand that there's nothing inappropriate going on here is that the situation of this story of Ruth and Boaz alone at night in the workplace at the threshing floor is so similar to the situation of two other stories in Scripture. I want to look at those two other stories because the context, the situation is incredibly similar, but the actions of Ruth and Boaz could not be more different from these other two stories. So it's a similar situation with an incredible contrast in the action of Ruth and Boaz, and these other two stories are really graphic. And so I know that there's 6th to 12th graders in the room, and so when the Bible talks about sexual sin, it's not euphemistic. It just tells you exactly what's happening. I'll try to not be as graphic as the Bible is as we talk about it this morning for the sake of our young folks in the room. So the first story happens in Genesis 19. It's the story of Lot and his daughters. Lot is Abraham's nephew. Abraham is the father of the nation of Israel. And Lot has fled into a cave with his two daughters, and they come up with a wild scheme to deceive him. They get him drunk. While he's drunk, they take advantage of him. He wakes up in the morning and doesn't know what's happened, and they both have sons by Lot. And initially, you read this story and you go, wow, those daughters, like, that was terrible. That was incredibly unrighteous. And it was, but we also have to remember that it's Lot's job in this culture to provide husbands for them. That's his job, to care for them. Without husbands, when Lot is dead, who's going to care for them? They would be left destitute. And the reason Lot hasn't provided husbands for them is because of sinful choices he's made previously that we see when he's living in Sodom, the city of Sodom, and now he moves to a cave out of fear, and now he is completely abdicating his responsibility as a father to provide for his daughters, and he's left them in a position of danger and vulnerability. And them in this position of vulnerability, because Lot has chosen not to use his power to care for them, they sin in trying to provide for themselves. It's a tough situation, and they all choose not to follow God's way. The second story comes from Genesis 38. It's Judah and Tamar. And if you thought the other story was bad, it just gets worse. Judah marries a Canaanite woman, which is against God's covenant because she didn't believe in God. And they have three sons together, and the oldest son marries a woman named Tamar. And the oldest son lives unrighteously and dies because of it. And so the next son, son number two, is the kinsman redeemer, is the guardian redeemer. It's his job to marry Tamar, but he doesn't want to do it. And in a way that's too graphic to describe this morning, he refuses to do that, and he dies. Well, now it's either the third brother's job, or if the third brother's too young, it's actually Judah's job himself to provide for Tamar. But instead of doing that, Judah blames Tamar and refuses to be the guardian redeemer, refuses to provide for her. So she comes up with a devious scheme to deceive him, to trick him into fathering a child with her, another case of him sinning and abusing. And it works, and she has a son, and the name of the son is Perez. Like Lot, Judah is the anti-redeemer. He does not care for the vulnerable woman. He uses his power to not only not care and provide, but to take advantage for his own gratification. He's unrighteous. He taught his sons to be unrighteous. And Tamar is this woman who experiences first tragedy, then discrimination and double standard, and then abuse at the hands of Judah. And she's just doing whatever she can to survive. And we can understand her actions, can't we? We can have compassion on the situation that Judah put her in. And we can rightly put most of the blame on Judah. But she, in this impossible and unfair situation, doesn't see any other way out than to not follow God's way. Lot and his daughters, Judah and his sons, and Tamar, they didn't trust God's way. They didn't pursue righteousness, only righteousness. It had consequences for them. It was dangerous and hurtful for them and for generations of their families after them. Because in the story of Lot and his daughters, the oldest daughter has a son, and that son's name is Moab. And Moab's family would grow into the nation of Moab, the Moabites, who for generations would fight against Israel. And Ruth is a Moabite. This is where she comes from. This is her family's legacy. And throughout chapter 2 and 3, how do they refer to Ruth? Specifically in these chapters, they go, the Moabite woman. They know where she came from. They know the story. What would they expect her to do? At the end of the book of Ruth, we get the family line of Boaz. And do you know where it starts? Verse 18, This then is the family line of Perez, the son of Judah and Tamar. This is Boaz's family. This is where he comes from. Will he act like his great, 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 great grandfather Judah when a vulnerable woman comes to him? Will Ruth act like her foremother in Lot's daughter when she's in a hard place? The situation is remarkably similar, and the narrator wants us to see that. And so Naomi comes up with a plan, and all of us as listeners who know the story of Lot and his daughters and who know the story of Judah and Tamar go, is it going to happen again? What is Naomi asking Ruth to do? Boaz worked hard all day. He had dinner and he had a drink. But he's not drunk. Unlike Lot, who didn't remember anything from the night, Boaz awakes and he's alert. Ruth wakes him up and he says, "Who are you?" Lot didn't know who it was. Judah didn't know who it was. Boaz wants to know. Boaz isn't interested in anything illicit or anything deceitful. And neither is Ruth. She's not in disguise. She's not hiding who she is. She says, "It's Ruth. Will you do what Judah would not do for Tamar? And will you do what Lot would not do for his daughters? Will you be our guardian redeemer?" And Boaz praises her for her righteousness. He says, "You're not just in this for yourself. You're not even just caring for yourself. You're caring for Naomi in this. That's why you're coming to me. You're doing this because of righteousness." And so he responds. Ruth has taken the initiative, and now he responds to the initiative she's taken to provide for her, not to leave her out to dry, not to abuse her, but to provide for her. He says, "I will do it. I will do it. If it's legal for me to do it, I will be your redeemer." And he says, "Here's a bundle of grain." This is a physical sign. In other words, you can take him at his word. He's not going to go back on it. This is a promise. It's an official engagement. In this private encounter, no one else watching, Ruth and Boaz don't cut corners. They don't deceive. They risk everything to follow God's way. Isn't that beautiful? In the Jewish collections of the Old Testament scriptures, as I was studying, I found out that Ruth can show up in different places. So in some collections of the Jewish Old Testament, it's after Judges, which is where we have it today. But in a few other ones, it's after Proverbs. And the reason it's after Proverbs is because Proverbs ends with this beautiful description of the strength and beauty of a righteous woman. Listen to what it says. It says, "The most important thing you can find in a woman is righteousness, is character. She works hard. She's responsible. She's trustworthy. She compassionately cares for the poor. She's strong in the midst of suffering. This is a righteous woman." The last verses of Proverbs say, "Charm is deceptive, beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Honor her for all that her hands have done. Let her works bring praise at the city gate." And then the book of Ruth starts, because that's who Ruth is. What does Boaz say to her when she comes to him at night? He says, "Everyone at the city of gate, at the gates of the city, have talked about your character." It's the same thing that Proverbs 31 says. And look at how Ruth and Boaz, in their interactions, they cut through all the externals that we so often in our culture focus on. Physical appearance, personality, all of these externals that are fine and wonderful, but what is it that Boaz sees in Ruth? Her righteousness. And what is it that Ruth sees in Boaz? It's his righteousness. And Boaz is righteous too. What happens when a woman is in a vulnerable situation and a man is in a position of power? What happens? How's he going to use that power? We saw Judah and we saw Lot abuse it. And so often in our lives and in the news, we see men take whatever cultural, physical, social power they have over women to take advantage of them. But here Boaz, while no one's watching, while maybe no one would ever know, while maybe no one would ever care because it's an immigrant woman, he gives everything he has to take care of her. That's righteousness. Isn't it beautiful? Look how he cares for her. He says, I don't want anyone talking or any rumors to start. Just stay here for the night. I don't want anything to happen to you on your walk home. Stay here. I'll protect you. I'll keep you safe. I'll send you back in the morning. I want to protect your honor. I want to protect your safety. He praises her and celebrates her for her character. I love how he does this in chapter 2, and Pastor Will talked about this in his message last week. In chapter 2, Ruth is out in the field, in the workplace. One of the fun things about chapter 2 and 3 is it's a workplace romance. It's a very The Office sort of situation here. It's a Jim and Pam kind of thing happening. She's working in the field, and Boaz sees her, and he sees she is vulnerable. And so he issues a company-wide memo that says, don't touch her. The word touch there means to harass or to mistreat. You see what's happening there? This is the oldest documented workplace anti-sexual harassment policy. That's what it is, right here in the Bible. To protect the vulnerable. Isn't that beautiful? So often in our world, because of sin, women are vulnerable and they're hurt because of men. And when Ruth comes right after the book of Proverbs, after the book of Ruth comes Song of Songs, which is a beautiful poem and song and tribute to the beauty of love in the context of marriage, to the beauty of marriage and sex and having children. Our wedding liturgy, as Anglicans, says that marriage is for the mutual joy, and if God blesses, for the having of children. And part of that mutual joy is a sexual relationship of husband and wife. In the stories we read this morning, we see how dangerous sex is outside of marriage. Someone always gets hurt. When there is sexual encounter activity outside of marriage, you might not feel it right away, you might not know it, but it's dangerous to your body, it's dangerous to your soul. Outside of marriage, there are ulterior motives and needs. There are imbalances in power, imbalances in commitment, and imbalances in consent. It is dangerous and hurtful. And the reason God gives us his way for sex within marriage is so we don't hurt one another. And so we don't hurt ourselves, because he knows what's good for us. And in sexual encounters outside of marriage, women always get hurt more. It's part of our brokenness and our fallenness. And so right here in the book of Ruth, Boaz gives us a picture of what a righteous man does. It's Father's Day. Guys, do you know what it means to be a man? This is it. Boaz. He's our picture, providing for others, caring for the vulnerable, following God's way. That's what it means to be a man. If you're a man, be a man like Boaz. If you're a woman, be a woman like Ruth. Not everyone's called to marriage or finds himself in marriage. If you're married, or if you're looking for a spouse and longing to be married, if you're a man looking for a wife, pray for a woman like Ruth. If you're a woman looking for a husband, pray for a husband like Boaz. If you're a man looking for a wife or who has a wife, be like Boaz. you're a woman with a husband or who's looking for a husband, be a woman like Ruth. And throughout this book, Boaz and Ruth don't have to be married to live righteously. Let's just be men and women like Boaz and Ruth, whatever the Lord calls us into. Let's pursue righteousness, only righteousness. You know, Jesus has a way of saying that too. He says it like this: seek first the kingdom of God and its righteousness. All these other things will be added to you. You'll be provided for, your clothes, your finances, your relational needs, everything else. It will all be provided, but seek first God's way, his kingdom, his righteousness. So often when we're in hard situations of life, we're like, I gotta figure out how to provide for myself. I gotta figure it out myself. And God says, no, no, no. Do the right thing. Follow God's good way. Everything else will be provided for by God. We don't do that, do we? We have all cut corners. We have all either stepped back from providing and caring for someone we needed to, or taken advantage of someone else in a relationship in a multitude of ways, or tried to provide for ourselves in ways that aren't good. We have all sinned in that way. And our sin has left each of us hurt and vulnerable. But God is a God who doesn't leave us vulnerable. He doesn't take advantage of us. He doesn't step back away from us. He is God the Father who gives his Son to us to be our guardian redeemer. He comes to us to bring his forgiveness and his healing. So in Jesus, Jesus fulfills all righteousness. He follows God's way. In the midst of his suffering, he chooses to believe that God's way is for his good and for the good of all people. And he goes to his death believing in that. And God provides life for him. He, Jesus, on the cross, takes on our unrighteousness, all of our failures to be men like Boaz and women like Ruth. He takes that all upon himself so that he can give us his righteousness. When we read about the story of Jesus' family line in the first gospel, the book of Matthew, we read the generations of his family, and Boaz and Ruth are there, honored for their righteousness. Do you know who else is there? Judah and Tamar. The righteousness of Jesus can purify even them, because there's nothing in you or my or our past or present that Jesus can't forgive and heal and purify and make righteous. We don't come to Jesus because of our own righteousness. Not by our own righteousness are we saved, but because of his mercy to give us his righteousness. He has begun a work of righteousness in every person who will come to him and confess. And he will make us righteous by his word and spirit. When we look at Ruth and Boaz, we're not seeing an unattainable picture of perfection. We're not simply seeing who we should be. We are seeing who we will be if we give our lives to following Jesus. We are seeing who we are in Christ. And we are seeing the picture of the beauty of righteousness that Jesus will work in the life of every man and woman who gives themselves to following his word.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from City of Light Anglican Church. We'd love to hear from you. You can find us online at cityoflightanglican.org. And now, may the light of Jesus scatter the darkness from before your path.